Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to learn from an expert. And certainly today, we're going to be learning about something that I would suggest many myths surround. And we're going to be talking about eating disorders. And there certainly are more than enough ideas about what eating disorder is and who it affects. So I would like to introduce you to Jennifer Rollin. Jennifer is an eating disorder therapist in Rockville, Maryland, and she specializes in working with adolescents and adults who are struggling with eating disorders. Jennifer Rollin, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Jennifer, let's just start off with your specialty because, you know, many people think about eating disorders as something that impacts young white female teenagers. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's a very common misconception. You know, eating disorders are mental illnesses and they don't discriminate. So while there is this stereotype that they only affect, you know, emaciated, Caucasian, young females, you know, I certainly see men in my practice. I see people of all ages. I see people across the weight spectrum. And I think that this stereotype can be really dangerous because it can prevent people who don't fit kind of that narrow criteria from seeking help. And we know that eating disorders, specifically anorexia, have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness, so it can be deadly, you know, if people are not getting that help.
Well, let's talk about what specifically an eating disorder is, because again, I think there are a lot of myths that surround that as well. So you tell us, what is an eating disorder?
Sure. So, you know, in our culture, we see a lot of disordered eating to the point where, you know, people have asked the question, well, does every woman struggle with an eating disorder? And I don't think that's the case. I definitely think we have an epidemic of disordered eating, but an eating disorder is something different. So for me, you know, of course we have the DSM criteria that we could look at, you know, and the specific categories that would be anorexia, you know, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and then, you know, otherwise specified feeding and eating disorder. However, I think that basically, a way to kind of simplify it would be when somebody's behaviors around food and their body really start to impede their functioning and impact their life. And, you know, those behaviors could really run a spectrum. And I think that it can be very unique to the person, kind of what their specific struggle is. You know, while we do see some commonalities, I think kind of the biggest eating disorder type behaviors fall into the categories of restricting. You know, so that would be under eating or restricting certain food groups, things of that nature. And then we see purging. So that could be somebody is vomiting, somebody's using exercise to compensate for food. And then we also see binging. So that's where somebody's kind of eating way past the point of, you know, physical hunger, you know, they're feeling completely out of control and starting to consume their life. But basically, I think that a general rule of thumb when it would be important to kind of reach out and get an assessment is if you notice for yourself or a loved one that, you know, they or yourself are becoming fixated and preoccupied with food and weight to the point where, you know, my clients share that it's taking up 90% of the thoughts that they're having. So it's very all-consuming, almost like if somebody had a drug addiction. You know, I think it's very different, but one commonality is that for people with, you know, addiction, often we find that their worlds become very small, and the whole focus is on that substance. And so it's similar for people with eating disorders. It's like their worlds become tiny and all-consumed with thoughts of, you know, did I eat this? What can I eat later? My weight, my body. So they start to become very isolated. And that is one of the most devastating, I think, impacts of eating disorders.
I want to go back and ask you about a couple of terms that you use just to make sure that everyone is clear about what you're referring to. You mentioned DSM, mm-hmm. the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. For those who are not clinicians, what is that?
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, how we give people mental health diagnoses. So it kind of, you know, looks at clusters of symptoms that we might see, you know, across the board. And then that's what we would use to diagnose somebody. You know, if they were struggling with an eating disorder, we'd look at, do they meet criteria? Do they have the symptoms? And so, you know, there are symptoms that indicate certain eating disorders. And then there's also the category of unspecified feeding or eating disorder and other specified feeding or eating disorder. And that's where somebody has a lot of the symptoms of, you know, some of these other eating disorders, but they, for whatever reason, don't meet full criteria. So they kind of fall into this other category.
Now, we know with the world of internet researching options, there are lots of people who will research, you name it, and they're going to the web to research it. Do you ever recommend that people take a look at the DSM to research their diagnosis, or would you rather they not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could really go either way. That probably wouldn't be my first line of approach. I think, especially because with eating disorders, there's a lot of denial. And actually, it's been to the point where there are studies that show there really are some brain differences. And it might not actually be denial. It's really more of kind of thought to be a impairment in brain functioning, where often people with eating disorders do not believe that they're ill. And we see that also with, you know, addiction. And so I think it's really important if someone thinks they're struggling to get assessed by a professional, because I think, you know, the DSM could be helpful for them in the sense of, oh, you know, I recognize some of these symptoms. But also there's an element of, if I don't meet that criteria specifically, then maybe I'm fine, if that makes sense. Or I'm able to recognize that, like, their body image is distorted. They're like, nope, I'm just humongous. Like, that's not a distortion. That's just what I see.
You know, the other thing that you've mentioned that I would suspect many people, or at least some of the folks who are listening today, are a little bit surprised by is your reference to eating disorders as being a mental illness. I'm not sure that folks, by and large, equate mental illness with an eating disorder.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the few mental illnesses where we judge someone's level of suffering on the basis of their physical condition, which is, again, very troubling. It really, you know, there's a common myth that people with eating disorders are vain, or it's caused by looking at pictures of models and, you know, being shallow, and that's very far from the truth. You know, the reality is that it is caused by genetics, as well as, you know, environmental triggers, but that really, it is a mental illness. And so it's not that a person is making the choice, you know, to restrict their food or, again, it's something that is beyond that person's control. And it's a real mental health concern.
You've also made the distinction between eating disorders and disordered eating. Can you give us more information about that?
Sure. I think that it's important to say that both are serious and can really impact functioning. So I don't want to say that just because someone's struggling with disordered eating and not an eating disorder, that they shouldn't seek help, because, you know, I've seen that disordered eating, you know, can have a lot of serious implications. I think when we look at disordered eating, that would be more, you know, somebody is maybe going on a lot of fad diets, or, you know, having some, you know, unhealthy attitudes around food. You know, maybe they have shame and guilt around eating a certain food group, but it's not to the point where it is kind of consuming their life and impacting their relationships, their functioning. You know, it's not taking up as much brain space for that person as somebody in the throes of an eating disorder, I think would be the easiest distinction. And of course, it is a spectrum, but I do think that an eating disorder is kind of, it's progressive, is the nature of the illness. If somebody doesn't get treatment, typically it doesn't just go away. It often will continue to get worse. Whereas someone might be able to maintain disordered eating for a long period of time and maybe not have as many life consequences and be able to function somewhat well, I think that somebody in the throes of an eating disorder, we often see a lot more impairment. and a lot more mental energy that is going towards the behaviors.
I see. And you've referenced specifically anorexia. Are there other kinds of eating disorders?
Yes. I think that's another common misconception, is that there's anorexia and bulimia and that's it. And so binge eating disorder was actually only recently added to the diagnostic statistical manual we mentioned earlier. So there's also binge eating disorder. There's otherwise specified feeding or eating disorder, as well as bulimia. There's also something called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. So yeah, there's a variety of different kind of eating disorder diagnoses. And I think that kind of one of the misconceptions is, if I don't have anorexia or I don't have bulimia, then it's not serious. And I think that it's important to note that all eating disorders are serious and can be life-threatening, regardless of what the specific diagnosis is.
Would you say that in general we are living in a society that to some extent glorifies, if you will, some forms of eating disorder and demonizes folks who by their appearance seem not to be almost ridiculously unhealthily thin?
Yeah, 100%. While I don't think that, so if society alone caused eating disorders, everyone would have an eating disorder, right? So I don't think that, I think there are genetics and, you know, temperament factors and psychological factors. So I don't think it's all society that causes eating disorders. However, I think that for people trying to recover from eating disorders, you know, it's very, very difficult in this cultural climate where everyone around them is talking and glorifying some disordered eating behaviors. So I think that makes it really hard for people who are trying to recover, because at times it goes against everything that they're hearing from the culture. And to the point you mentioned about weight stigma, that's also kind of a passion of mine, both as it relates to eating disorder recovery and recognizing that, you know, you can have a serious eating disorder across the weight spectrum. You can be in a larger body and have an eating disorder. I also do think there is real weight stigma in our society, which makes it really hard for, I think, people in general, and also for people in eating disorder recovery, regardless of their size, but particularly for those in larger bodies, because they're facing real oppression, you know, through the culture on often, you know, a daily basis.
Can you look at someone and say, she or he's really thin, oh, that person is really overweight, they've got an eating disorder? Can you tell by looking?
No, I don't think so, no, because again, you know, an eating disorder is a mental illness, and I think that too often in our culture, we think we can tell things about people's physical or mental health based on how they look, you know, and you can be fat and fit, you could be thin and unfit, you can be in a larger body and have a restrictive eating disorder. You can be, you know, I have clients who are in smaller bodies who struggle with binge eating disorder. So you really can't tell by looking at somebody if they're struggling with an eating disorder.
Let's talk a little bit about the specific definitions of some of the other disorders that you work with that folks may not necessarily be aware of. Mm-hmm. You mentioned bulimia. Just give us a thumbnail of what bulimia is. I think that's one that folks believe that they have an understanding of. But just from your professional perspective, what is bulimia?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it definitely can look different for different people. Everyone's eating disorder is a little bit unique. But generally what we see is, you know, episodes of binge eating. So, you know, that again can look different for different people, but typically that's, you know, eating within a certain amount of time, an amount of food that's larger than most people would eat during that period, a sense of like feeling out of control over what they're eating, you know, eating alone because they're feeling embarrassed by the quantity, And then for someone with bulimia, what we typically see is following that binge, we see some sort of compensatory behavior. So we might see them self-inducing vomiting. They might be using laxatives. And something else that I think is not always recognized is excessive exercise. So I sometimes see clients who have a binge episode and then they compensate through exercising the next day. And again, I think that's often very glorified in our society. So it's not seen as problematic. But so typically we see that with bulimia. We also see that the person's like self-concept and how they view themselves is very influenced by their body weight and shape. And that, you know, those symptoms are happening pretty frequently. I think it's at least once a week for 3 months. And so that is similar when it comes to binge eating disorder. We just don't see, we see the binging without any compensatory behavior. So they're not purging or exercising, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. You say excessive exercise might be a response to binge eating. And as you know, every time we turn around, there's a different recommendation about exercise. 5 minutes a day, an hour a day, you know, it's all over the place. So what's your definition of excessive exercise?
Sure. So first off, it's important, I think, to note that excessive exercise can be a symptom of anorexia as well as bulimia. And I also see clients with binge eating disorder who struggle with that as well. So, yeah, I think when we're looking at excessive exercise, which also I might call compulsive exercise, what we really see is a few things. So a lot of rigidity around exercise routine, a sense of guilt and shame if the exercise routine is broken. Obviously, some people might find they're starting to increase their exercise to get more of the same effect. You know, we might see people exercising despite illness or injury. So they're sick or their doctor has advised them that they really should not be exercising and they can't stop exercising to compensate, you know, for food that they've eaten. So, I think for me, it's less about the amount of exercise because, of course, there are, you know, endurance athletes who exercise for really long periods of time, but they might not have compulsive exercise. For me, it's really the mentality and the mindset. So do I feel like I'm making the choice to move my body? Like, am I enjoying what I'm doing? Or is it more, I feel like I'm a slave to the treadmill and I don't have a choice because if I miss, I feel incredible anxiety, guilt, and shame.
Okay. You talked about binge eating, and I'm wondering if you can give us a thumbnail sketch between the difference between binge eating and bulimia.
Sure. So with binge eating, again, both bulimia and binge eating involve, you know, the binging episodes. However, typically with binge eating disorder, we don't see the compensatory behavior that we would see in bulimia.
Okay.
So we're not seeing any self-induced vomiting. We're not seeing them using laxatives. We're not seeing them purging through exercise. I guess that's the main difference. Although I will say it is not uncommon for me in my practice because, again, people don't fit into these, like, perfect little boxes of, you know, diagnostic categories. Typically, it's not uncommon for me to see someone with binge eating disorder who also struggles with restricting, you know, the day following a binge. And that might be because they're, like, physically not hungry at all. It also might be because they're feeling guilty about the binge or both.
Gotcha.
And we know that restricting really exacerbates binging. Like, it's a big trigger.
Interesting. Jennifer, we're going to take a break. And when we return, I'd like to talk just for a second or two about pica and rumination disorder. Again, I think these are experiences that many people are perhaps unaware of. And I think it's just important to get a broad picture of what eating disorders can actually look like. So, folks, we will continue with Jennifer Rollin, who is an eating disorder specialist located in Rockville, Maryland. We'll be right back. Thank you. Jennifer Rollin, as an eating disorder specialist, you've worked with a number of people who come to you with lots of different looks, if you will, to their eating disorders. Tell us a little bit about pica and rumination disorder.
Sure. So I actually don't see a ton of those two in my practice. I think one reason is kind of they're lesser known and people might not always seek help for them. Also, rumination disorder often occurs in, infants or really young children. And I don't work with young children, but essentially rumination disorder is when people, are repeatedly regurgitating their food for a period of at least a month. And, the regurgitation is not due to some kind of medical condition, and it's not happening, in the course of one of these other eating disorders that we've discussed. There's a variety of theories as to what causes rumination disorder. There's suspected to be some kind of genetic component, and then environmental stressors, physical neglect or abuse might trigger it. And then with pica, it's kind of looking at somebody who's eating something that is not a nutritious substance for a period of at least a month. So somebody might eat paint or dirt, and it's inappropriate to the developmental level of the person. So, we wouldn't probably be seeing, children might sometimes do that, but this is something that's out of the norm of typical development. And it's also not part of, some kind of cultural, practice. So yeah, those are two lesser known eating disorders that I don't see as much in my practice, but I think it's important for people to know that, they exist and that they do impact people.
One of the things that I think I'm hearing from you is that you can't all by yourself look at your behavior or the behavior of someone else and say, yes, that's an eating disorder. No, that's not an eating disorder. So are there generic signs and symptoms that might suggest to someone that it's time to at least reach out for a conversation, an evaluation mm-hmm. with a specialist, or is it different for each eating disorder experience?
There are some differences, but there are also some red flags that we might pick up on. One would be, a preoccupation with food. If somebody is suddenly kind of talking more about food, collecting recipes, looking at pictures of food, that could be one sign of malnutrition. If we're seeing somebody is suddenly cutting out, groups of food that were once okay, it's like they've suddenly decided to become a vegetarian with no interest in animal welfare before. And often with eating disorders, that can be progressive. So maybe somebody starts by saying, I'm cutting out carbohydrates, and then you notice they've now cut out dairy. So anytime that somebody is developing any kind of like rigid rules around food, which again could be certain food groups that they're restricting, it could also be, I only eat at these specific times throughout the day, or having like kind of strange eating behaviors. And of course, these rules invoke a sense of like guilt and anxiety if they're broken. We might also see like if somebody is using condiments or beverages in a strange way, that might be one sign of an eating disorder. Often for people struggling with anorexia, they might be, using a ton of mustard or other types of condiments. We might also see them, drinking diet beverages or coffee in an attempt to feel full. Another red flag for anyone, I think, struggling with an eating disorder is that preoccupation that I talked about with weight, body size, and food. So suddenly somebody is weighing themselves a lot, talking about the size of their body, having an intense fear of weight gain. It's also important to notice any weight changes. If somebody suddenly, loses a bunch of weight, that would be kind of a red flag. But again, it's important to note that somebody does not have to even be underweight or emaciated to be struggling. And then I think another big warning sign kind of across the eating disorder spectrum is often for people who are struggling, kind of the eating disorder starts to consume their life and become their primary relationship. So we might start to notice that, you're a child, you know, used to have a lot of friends, enjoy hanging out with people, and suddenly they don't want to go out anymore. They want to isolate themselves because of anxiety of being around food. So I think, you know, signs that they've become more isolative, that they're not as interested in things that they used to care about, and they're hyper-fixated on food, weight, and their body. Another thing that I just want to point out about red flags is that I think in our culture, it's very socially sanctioned to decide that you want to be healthier, whatever that means for you. But we also really need to look out for somebody who is doing it in a socially sanctioned way. Like maybe they've decided they're quote unquote eating clean, or they've developed a new exercise routine. But if you're noting that like rigidity where the person is like having anxiety about going out to eat because their safe foods, quote unquote, are not going to be on the menu, like even if it's under the guise of healthy eating, that can also be a sign of one of these eating disorders. Or of another emerging eating disorder, which is not yet in the DSM, but is kind of gaining attention, called orthorexia, which is that preoccupation with healthy eating.
That's interesting, because I think that many people would say, well, what's wrong with being preoccupied with healthy eating? But I think what you're saying is if that preoccupation really begins to take over and change behaviors, that's when... you know, it's something worth looking at.
Yeah. So it's different from like really liking kale or deciding that like you want to find movement you enjoy. Like that is not necessarily an indication of an eating disorder. When that person's fixation on healthy eating is to the point where, again, it's impacting their quality of life, where they have a birthday party coming up where they know cake is going to be served and like they're anxious about it a week in advance and contemplating not going. So it's really to the point where that interest in healthy eating has become an obsession, and it's kind of taken over their life.
We've been certainly talking about lots of different aspects of eating disorders. Early on, you indicated that eating disorders don't really discriminate. But are there some eating disorders that are more likely to show up in men than in women, in children and adolescents versus adults, or is it really just the range?
Yeah. So statistically, you know, it's indicated that fewer men struggle with eating disorders than women. However, what we know is there's a lot of stigma and shame for men, and many men are not getting treatment or reporting. So I would guess those numbers are probably a lot higher. And honestly, I really see it across, you know, I have clients ranging from age 13. I've had clients in their 60s. I see males. I see females. I see, you know, non-binary individuals. I see people of all ethnicities. So I really think that, again, you know, when you think of it like depression doesn't discriminate. Anyone can get depression. It doesn't matter, you know, what socioeconomic status you're in, what gender you are, and it's the same with eating disorders. I mean, they really don't discriminate.
The idea that a man could actually have, well, any sort of disorder, but certainly an eating disorder, particularly given that it's so often connected to women, do you think that that is part of what may keep men from seeking treatment?
Absolutely. And I've talked with that about that with male clients, how hard it is for them, you know, if they go to a treatment center for an eating disorder, you know, being one of the only men there often. And again, it's not because men don't struggle. I really think that the numbers are a lot higher, but there is, it's seen as like a women's illness. But I definitely think that, you know, impedes a lot of men from getting the help that they need. And so many of them are going, in my opinion, untreated.
Once an eating disorder, always an eating disorder, or is there hope for change and cure?
Yeah, so I think there's 100% hope for recovery from eating disorders. Like, it's not something that someone has to live with for the rest of their life. I do think, you know, while you can be fully recovered from an eating disorder and there's so much hope, you know, it also, there is that genetic predisposition. So, like, someone with an eating disorder can never go on a diet, the same way somebody, you know, with alcoholism can never have a drink, which honestly, I mean, I don't think anyone needs to go on a diet. I don't think they're helpful. so I think that's fine. But, you know, I think it's important for people to be aware of, you know, what their triggers are and, you know, how to cope if some of the eating disorder thoughts start coming up again. And I do think it's something that doesn't have to consume the rest of your life and that you can completely recover from.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that you don't think the diets are helpful because, you know, all of the dietary products and programs, they're probably twisting around inside of their heads. As you say, you don't particularly think diets are helpful. Why is that? It's such a money-making industry.
Yeah, it's a $60 billion industry. This is probably one of my favorite topics. But so diets, when we look at the research, just purely the research, I think it's like 95 to 97% of people who diet will lose weight in the short term and then gain it back in the long term, which we define as a three-year period. So there's also studies that show that the more dieting attempts that somebody has, the more their natural body weight can actually be pushed higher. So often diets can actually result in people being in higher weights. And then we also know not just that diets, quote unquote, don't work in the sense of maintaining weight loss. They also can cause a lot of harm in that one in four people who diet, it can, if you, again, have the underlying genetics, it can progress to an eating disorder. And of those people who don't develop an eating disorder, it can lead a lot of people to not liking themselves, you know, messing up their relationship to food. And again, I think we have to look at the diet industry in that they make a lot of money off of selling these products and convincing people that, you know, their bodies are not okay as they are. And it's just interesting to me in that if there was any other treatment with that low of a success rate, you know, I don't think it would be prescribed by doctors. There's no evidence to support that they're beneficial, and there's a lot of evidence to support that they're actually harmful to people.
That's really interesting. And it's a $60 billion with a B dollar industry.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's why, and again, looking at kind of the medical model, part of, you know, I don't know if you would consider this the diet industry, I would, or the medical industry, but we also have to look at things like if your doctor is recommending a diet to you or, you know, a weight loss drug, like those are very profitable industries as well. Kind of the weight loss industry as a whole, bariatric surgery, weight loss pills. So again, I mean, there's a lot of financial interest vested in promoting, you know, something that ultimately does not help people to be healthier or happier.
So when you say it's a $60 billion industry, are you including the medications and the surgeries, or are you just focusing on the various diet programs and products?
I think that number is just referencing the diet programs and products.
Oh,
I don't think that that includes like weight loss pills, because I suspect that would be a lot higher.
That's an extraordinary number, and certainly a very compelling reason for society really not to do a whole lot to change the overall mm-hmm. view of how to deal with body image and weight loss.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for my clients, again, the majority of people I see have eating disorders or body image concerns. But regardless, if somebody does not have an eating disorder, I really look at how can you feel happy, healthy, both mentally and physically, and like what are some habits that you can do to get there that do not involve any sense of punishment, restriction, guilt or shame, rules. So, you know, I'm not just saying that I'm going to help people to change their lifestyle, because that's really a diet in disguise, in my opinion. But I think there's a way to kind of, because when I talk with people about giving up dieting, you know, often it's like, well, you just want me to give up on my health. And I'm like, that's not the case, actually. I think that there are ways to improve your health through kindness and compassion, and rather than this self-punishment and these rules, like, you know, I think you can be healthy and eat foods that you enjoy and learn how to nourish your body in a way that feels good to you and find gentle movement that you enjoy And I think dieting, it teaches us not to trust our bodies. And so for somebody who's in the way later stages of eating disorder recovery, or for somebody who's just trying to heal, you know, from a disordered relationship with food, we really look at learning how to trust their body's innate wisdom and intuition, you know, like people do when they're little kids. And again, learning some other ways to enhance your health and happiness that don't involve, you know, food restriction rules or guilt.
So it sounds like a complete change in, again, how you think about yourself and how you think about the world around you. And it also sounds like it's a lot of hard work, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely say it's a paradigm shift, and it takes a lot of work to kind of decondition a lot of these cultural messages that we've received. However, I don't know. I would argue that dieting, hating yourself, you know, being trapped in disordered eating, that's pretty mentally exhausting. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of money. So imagine if you invested, you know, the time, mental energy, and money that people invest into diet products, you know, diet programs, bashing their bodies and themselves into, you know, self-compassion and reconnecting with their sense of hunger and fullness. They would really see some radical shifts and a better return on their investment.
It's interesting to hear you reference the concept of self-compassion. I would suggest it's certainly for someone who sees themselves as having a challenge with food intake. Self-compassion, as you've said before, that's really not part of the picture. There's so much, as you've said before, so much shaming and blaming around food intake and body type and shape and all of that, that self-compassion almost seems like a foreign language for folks struggling with those issues.
It definitely is. And I think it's a big, big part of my treatment approach. You know, obviously eating disorders and body image issues are very complex. So there are a few different approaches that I integrate, you know, the more traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as dialectical behavioral therapy. But the third element that I think is incredibly important is this concept of self-compassion. I find that my clients in particular really struggle often with beating themselves up, you know, perfectionism at times, holding themselves to really harsh standards and having an incredibly unkind inner critic, which I don't think is terribly uncommon in our culture, unfortunately. But I find that you know, I explain to clients, and I love explaining it, especially with my teen clients. And I had some the other day, and I asked them, you know, are you familiar with the concept of self-compassion? And a lot of people say, no, I've never heard of that. What is that? And so we talk about kind of the things that they're saying to themselves, and learning really how to say and treat themselves in a way that is kinder. And I think that applies really to people in eating disorder recovery, because it's not, you know, a linear process. Of course, they're going to have setbacks along the way, but also just to life and to learning how to relate to yourself in a way that is kinder, which I think is a lot more supportive of people achieving their goals and having a better quality of life than the sense of self-punishment and self-criticism.
Absolutely. Jennifer, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Jennifer, I noticed that you also work with individuals who experience anxiety and trauma. Would you say there is a direct connection between trauma and eating disorders, or no?
I think it depends. I certainly have clients who have trauma histories. I also have clients who don't. And I definitely think there can be a connection, in the sense of, for some people, their eating disorder behaviors are ways to kind of cope and try to regulate, traumatic stress. So that's certainly a connection. Again, it's not for everyone, but I do see that with some people. I also see a huge correlation with anxiety and depression, but specifically with anxiety. I see a big connection in that many of my clients also struggle with, generalized anxiety, social anxiety, and specifically as it relates to anorexia recovery, I see it very, very much as an anxiety disorder for anorexia in specific, and that really guides the treatment.
You indicated earlier that there is hope, and that recovery can occur. And you talked about CBT and DBT as part of your therapeutic toolkit, if you will. What exactly is CBT? What is DBT? And how are they helpful?
Sure. So in a nutshell, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, really looks at our thoughts and how that shapes our behaviors and our emotions. So basically, kind of the way I describe it to people is, let's say two students took an exam and they both got C's. And so one student, is a straight-A student. She studies a lot. And so she's crying hysterically. The C in her mind is a failure. The other student didn't show up to class, didn't prepare, and is elated that they got a C and that they passed the test. The same external event, two different thoughts that are causing two different emotions. So with CBT, we really look at the person's thinking patterns. Dialectical behavioral therapy is very similar to CBT. However, I tend to lean a little more towards it because it also integrates the mindfulness component, and I find it's a little less judgmental. So with CBT, we might look at a thought as being distorted or, rational. With dialectical behavioral therapy, it's like, I don't really need to argue with you. Is that thought true? I look at, is that thought helpful? If a client's thought is, I'm huge and disgusting, like, we don't need to debate back and forth as to whether they're viewing themselves inaccurately. It's like, okay, so how does telling yourself that make you feel? And what are the urges that come up? So maybe for someone with an eating disorder, the urge is, I want to restrict, or, I want to binge and purge. And so that thought isn't really helpful. So we look at, like, what might be a more helpful coping statement to tell yourself when you're having some of these unhelpful thoughts. And we also look at, I think I talked about before, how sometimes eating disorder behaviors are a way that somebody is getting their needs met. So I look at, I talk with clients, if they're having an urge to lose weight or to restrict, we'll look at them and I'll ask them, well, what are you looking to feel through that restriction? Or, like, what do you think that would bring you? And so then we look at, let's say a client says, I want to feel calm. Okay. So what are some other more adaptive ways that you could feel calm? Maybe they want to try meditation. So it's really, we're not just taking away the eating disorder behaviors. We really need to also help the client to have some more adaptive behaviors that are in line with their values so that they have a way to cope, because the eating disorder has served them in some sense. It's helped them to cope with trauma, maybe with anxiety, with feeling out of control in their life. So it's really looking at, like, what can we add in, to help them learn new coping skills and new tools. So that's kind of, I guess, it's obviously very complex. There's a lot of different components, but that's kind of like the boiled down version. In some ways, I might apply those two types of treatment.
Do you find in working with clients who are older, who are 50, 60 and above, that there is a social component that really helps them to come to you or that detracts from their work with you, or does age not matter?
Yeah, age matters in the sense of when you have a teenager, an adolescent, you know, their parent is often the one bringing them to treatment. They feel at times like they have less of a choice in the matter. I think with an adult, you know, it's really they're the one who has to make that choice ultimately. Like, you know, family and friends can obviously push them to get treatment, but there's a little bit more of the sense of, you know, their parent is not driving them to the session. Like, they have to decide to come. And I think there also is a lot of stigma for being older and having an eating disorder. You know, I've had clients say to me, but I am not a teenager. I can't have an eating disorder. And, you know, like we said, they impact people of all ages. I definitely think, you know, being older, the person might be able to have a little more insight, you know, but again, it really depends on the person.
If you have survived your teenage years and now you are a young adult and you've not had an eating disorder, can you mm-hmm. develop one as you get older?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I have seen that in my practice, and that I think there's also the misconception that older people with eating disorders are people who've been struggling since they were teens, which I definitely see. But you can also develop an eating disorder later in life, and that is happening more and more. Again, you know, we know that these people have the underlying genetics and that, you know, maybe they had some protective factors growing up, but maybe, you know, again, as they're dealing with other environmental stressors, you know, possibly children leaving the home or, you know, transitions in work, you know, losing some of their roles in the sense of, again, like children leaving the house or other stressors that might come up later in life, those can certainly trigger the underlying genetic predisposition, which might have not been triggered previously.
I see. A lot of times, particularly with adolescents and children, you know, parents find themselves fighting with the child to eat or to eat differently mm-hmm. or to eat in a healthy fashion. Is that useful?
Do you mean for someone in recovery or like just for a child in general?
For someone who's trying to recover or somebody who doesn't believe they have a problem, but from the parents' view, they really do.
Yeah. So I think with children or teens, often it is really important for parents to get in the driver's seat and to, you know, there's one treatment model called family-based therapy where we do empower parents to kind of take on all of the meals. And kind of the motto is life stops until you eat. Like, it's the child has to eat, or, you know, we look at activities being taken away because, you know, the thought is this person is not thinking rationally. You know, when somebody's brain is malnourished, they're not able to make choices often that align with their best interests. And so what I talk about with families, you know, of teenagers who maybe don't think they have a problem, and don't think that they need to eat or think that they, you know, shouldn't be eating as much as they actually require, we really look at empowering parents, again, to take control of the food piece until the child is, you know, nourished enough to and, you know, mentally healthy enough to be able to feed themselves. Because, again, it's what we talk about is you're not fighting against your child. It's everybody is working together against the eating disorder.
If you've got a child, though, who likes the fact that he or she is very thin, mm-hmm. I would think that there would be a lot of battles between the family and that child around the issue of food and eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why it's important to bring a professional in, because there can be a lot of success. And I've worked with parents, you know, who have been able to refeed their kids. And yes, I mean, some of that, the temper tantrums and screaming and that stuff will happen. But ultimately, I think that, you know, if intervention happens and there's a professional to support them in that process and, you know, tell them what's normal and what isn't, I certainly think that it's 100% possible. for kids to recover that way, with the family really taking on, as you can imagine, it's incredibly difficult, but it also can be so healing for kids.
You know, a lot of times, I would suggest, certainly with adults, who appear to be struggling with eating issues, it's common for somebody else to say, "Why are you doing that to yourself? You should just stop, push away from the table, you name it. What's wrong with you?" Are there things that you really shouldn't say to adults in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think anything that's shaming or blaming or kind of the just eat, why can't you just do that, or why can't you just stop eating, again, it insinuates that that person is choosing to struggle with an eating disorder, and it's important to not kind of reinforce that stigma and shame, which really, I think, prevents people from getting help and perpetuates eating disorders. I think any weight-based comments would also not be helpful, so telling them, "Wow, you know, you really look like you lost weight. I'm worried about you." While that comes from a good place, that often is exactly what somebody who's restricting wants to hear, and that can make them restrict even more. Or telling someone, "You look so healthy, you've gained weight." Well, for someone with an eating disorder, often the thought is, you know, "I'm large now, I'm fat." So really trying to stay away from appearance-based comments and instead voicing concerns over behavior. So I'm noticing that you're not eating meals out with us. Sharing with the person that, you know, "I know you're not choosing to struggle with this, and I'm here to support you in any way that I can," whether that's helping you get professional treatment or, you know, a variety of other options, but really taking that shame and judgment piece out of it. Again, it's kind of like telling somebody with a broken leg, like, "Just walk. Why can't you just walk?" And obviously, I think many people with eating disorders, they want nothing more than to be able to just eat normally. But again, they're struggling with a serious mental illness. So it's having some understanding that it is really hard for them, and also that full recovery is possible with treatment.
We certainly know that there was a time, and it's shifting now, in the world of quote-unquote fashion, where you had to be a certain height, certain shoe size, and really 100 pounds, 110, 115 was kind of the max. After that, you know, a lot of times you were seen as carrying too much weight. Now we have not, we still have that, but we also have the other end of that, which is celebrate your body, whatever size it is. Whoever you are in your body, you are a beautiful human being. Is that helpful?
Yeah, there's two important messages. One message is that all bodies are good bodies. And also, I mean, there's no weight where somebody becomes somebody who's not valuable, or there's no weight limit on beauty. The secondary message, though, is that our worth is so much more than our bodies, and that, again, this is a message that diet culture sells to us, but that we're all innately worthy as human beings just because we are. And I think when we focus on our bodies as a vision of our worth, again, it's really boarding a sinking ship, because, you know, our bodies are meant to change as we age. I often talk about this. They're not slabs of marble that are set in stone, not expected to, you know, change, whether that is signs of aging or weight gain or body shape changes. And so when we put all of our self-worth into our appearance, it's really a recipe for chasing discontent. So I really encourage people, you know, to focus on, yes, like, my body is beautiful. And, you know, honestly, to me, I always tell clients, like, my aim is not for you to necessarily look in the mirror and be like, "I love my body, I'm gorgeous." Like, you know, my aim is to really shift focus onto body gratitude, like being thankful for the things your body enables you to do. And also really to shift focus onto your values and living your life. Because ultimately, our worth in this world is not to take up less space. A hyperfixation on that takes us away from our true values and from actually doing things that are meaningful.
Jennifer, there's so much more that we could talk about. As we close out our time today, is there a website, or are there websites that listeners can go to learn more about your work and what you're doing?
Sure. I think the quickest and easiest way to reach me would be on my website. It's Jennifer, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R, Rollin, R as in rock, O-L-L-I-N.com. And there's a contact form on there as well as my number, and that's a way to reach me or kind of read some of the articles that I write.
And you are a writer for Huffington Post, yes?
Yes, and I also, I write for Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and a couple other places. So that would also be a quick way just to Google Huffington Post, my name, my articles should come up.
Terrific.
That way as well.
Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your expertise with us here at Mind Talk.
Thank you so much.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is available to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store, or you can sign up at iTunes for the Mind Talk podcasts on a daily basis. If you are listening, and I know you are, I'd love to hear from you and tell me where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk. Send me an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That's P-A-M-E-L-A. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.